You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at The Diplomat. I'm pleased to announce that I'm joined on this episode of the podcast by Michael Kugelman, a senior associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Michael is absolutely prolific on South Asia in a variety of publications, including at The Diplomat. I'm very glad to have him on here today. Michael, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be talking with you.
Absolutely, Michael. So, I want to devote this podcast to recent events in South Asia's most important bilateral relationship, that between India and Pakistan, which naturally leaves us a lot to talk about. So let's rewind a bit to Christmas Day 2015, which was just over a week ago, I believe 9 days ago, as of this recording, when those of us here in the United States woke up to images of Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, hugging and grinning his grinning with his Pakistani counterpart Nawaz Sharif, and in many ways, this was a remarkable photo op for those of us that watched the subcontinent. But what did this actually bear in terms of diplomatic heft? And given the longer trajectory of how the Modi government has handled the relationship with Pakistan in its 19 months in power, were you taken off guard?
Well, I was certainly surprised, as so many other people were, but I would not say that I was completely shocked that Modi decided to go to Lahore. And I say that because, as you know, there had been a series of developments good developments in India-Pakistan diplomacy in the weeks leading up to Modi's surprise visit to Lahore. There had been a national security advisors meeting between the two countries in Thailand. There had been a very brief meeting on the sidelines of the Paris Climate Conference between Prime Ministers Modi and Sharif. And then at that Heart of Asia regional security conference in Pakistan, basically the India and Pakistan agreed to resume their comprehensive dialogue, which was quite a big deal given that it had been suspended since the Mumbai terror attack 7 years earlier. So after all that happened, that's why I thought that it could not have been out of the realm of possibility that the Indian Prime Minister would make a visit to Pakistan. But certainly it was a surprise that it happened so soon. I think many people may have thought, including me, that Modi would make a visit to Pakistan sometime in 2016, later in 2016, but not on Christmas Day 2015. Now, in terms of what it actually bore, in terms of products, outcomes, this was a 100% symbolic visit. There was no substance to it at all. I mean, the two leaders, they had a nice chat. I think they spoke for about an hour. And basically what they concluded in that chat is that the two of them needed to chat more, which is good, but, no major announcements. So, what I had been saying in the immediate aftermath of that visit is that, Modi came to Pakistan bearing birthday wishes for Prime Minister Sharif. He was not bearing a peace treaty or anything like that. It was the Prime Minister of Pakistan's birthday. It was also the wedding day, or the forthcoming wedding day of Sharif's granddaughter, and I think Modi decided to use that as a pretext to stop by and say hello. But certainly, it was very powerful symbolically, just because it had been, more than a decade since an Indian Prime Minister had visited Pakistan. Modi's predecessor, Manmohan Singh, had wanted to do it for a number of years, but never had. So, on symbolism alone, I think it's a big deal, particularly because, only a few months ago, India and Pakistan were firing accusations and slinging insults back and forth. Things were looking really bad. So things have really improved, or had improved, in a hurry.
Right. And now, of course, India isn't the only actor with agency in the bilateral. So, when we're discussing Pakistan's foreign and security policy, like we are with the bilateral with India, it's obviously apt to take stock of where the Pakistani military stands. And a few other developments I might point to include, General Rahil Sharif, the Chief of Army Staff, had visited Washington in November. And another development that some observers pointed to as an indicator of a possible convergence between the civilian government in Pakistan and the military was the appointment of Lieutenant General Nasir Khan Janjua as Pakistan's National Security Advisor in October. And this suggested that essentially the Pakistani military had granted its approval to the to some rapprochement with New Delhi. What do you make of these developments, and do you think they played an important role?
Absolutely, yeah. I think you just identified two of the major reasons why we've had this sudden attempt at some point of some level of rapprochement between India and Pakistan. One is General Raheel Sharif's relatively recent visit to Washington, when I'm quite sure that the U.S. pressured him hard to allow Pakistan's civilian leadership to have high-level negotiations or high-level talks with India. I think that there's been a lot of U.S. pressure for quite some time. When Prime Minister Sharif was in Washington, just over the course of the last few months, I think that the U.S. has been pushing not just the Pakistanis and the Pakistani military, but also the Indians, particularly, to get back to the table and talk. Just because, you know, let's face it, the last thing that Washington wants right now is to have another conflict on the subcontinent, on the nuclear-armed subcontinent, given the fact that the U.S. wants to dedicate all of its national security capital, so to speak, on dealing with the threat of Islamic State, of ISIS. And I think that it worries that, if the subcontinent were to become a big distraction, if it were to become a flashpoint again, that could really pose a lot of problems for the U.S. and its allies as it tries to dedicate much of its focus on ISIS. And the other issue is really a personnel move. The fact that you have a recently retired Pakistani general recently appointed as the national security advisor. It's someone that the Pakistani military, obviously trusts and is willing to have seated there at the table talking to India's civilian leadership. And I think the Indians also see that as an advantage because they feel that, most Pakistani civilian officials are not worth talking to simply because they're essentially puppets of the military. They really don't have any sort of ability to act autonomously. This is the view from India. And I think that India, knowing that there's now a very recently retired general serving the role of national security advisor, actually makes it more meaningful and more worth it, so to speak, for the Indians to actually sit down and talk with the Pakistani civilian leadership.
Mm-hmm. And of course, in the past 24 or 48 hours, things have gotten significantly more complicated. And I know, when Modi landed in Lahore, a lot of commentators, myself included, I think you as well, in an interview that I read that you'd done, suggested that spoilers could be around the corners, and it appears that has panned out as a group of six terrorists attacked the Indian Air Force station at Pathankot, a town in northern Punjab, just south of the border of the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir, and very close to the border with Pakistan. Now, this complicates the narrative somewhat, right? Because reports out of India, including reports citing senior intelligence officials, are saying that this the group of attackers could have been affiliated with Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is a designated terrorist group and Kashmiri separatist group that is thought to have close links to the Pakistani military. So which, again, brings up the question of just to what extent the Pakistani military has truly given its imprimatur to the current rapprochement. So what are your first impressions of the longer-term effect of the attacks at Pathankot? Obviously, the dust is still settling. We don't have, all the details of what exactly transpired and who the attackers are. I think the identity issue is going to be something that's going to linger with us for a while. But what are your first impressions?
Well, I mean, certainly this attack threatens to set back progress in bilateral relations very quickly. I mean, the fact that this attack happened just days after Modi's visit to Pakistan is very significant, though it seems like we're now hearing that Indian intelligence alerts were received that suggesting that terrorists could be headed to that airbase, several days before Modi's visit. So in other words, the Indians knew for a while that something could be happening. And this is an Air Force base. This was not an attack on civilians. It was a direct assault on the Indian military. And that's really significant. I think it'll be very difficult for the Indians to let that go so quickly. And also, not too long ago, on Monday, a consortium of Kashmiri militants, the UJC, actually claimed responsibility for the attack. Now, whether that's accurate or genuine is unclear, but you know, any sort of umbrella group of Kashmiri militants claiming responsibility for an attack suggests that you really do need to think about the Pakistani security establishment, given that so many of these Kashmir militants have very strong direct links to the Pakistani security establishment. You know, in terms of what's going to happen now, as you say, things are still playing out. It's hard to tell. My sense is that the Modi government has decided to take a very principled position in favor of engagement and talks. So I wouldn't say that this Air Force, this Patanko attack is going to torpedo the dialogue completely. I mean, there certainly is a possibility that the foreign secretary level talks, which are scheduled to happen, or I think on the 15th of January, could be postponed so that the national security advisors could meet instead to try to hash things out. And quite frankly, I think the Indians would welcome NSA level talks more than foreign secretary level talks, because then they could deal with General Janjua. And I think that would give NSA level talks would give the Indians perhaps a more appropriate platform to advance their concerns about this Patanko attack and you know, what the Pakistanis can do about it. But, you know, quite frankly, in terms of Pakistan's role in this, you know, many Indians assume that the Pakistani army orchestrated this directly, essentially in an effort to get back at the Pakistani civilian leadership for going out there and meeting with the Indian Prime Minister, even though I imagine that meeting between Prime Minister Sharif and Prime Minister Modi could not have happened without some level of approval or buy-in from the Pakistani army. You know, as you know, it's very complicated in terms of the level of linkages, relationships that Pakistan's security establishment has with the types of groups that India believes are responsible for this attack. I mean, certainly the Pakistani military establishment has a long relationship with Jaish-e-Mohammed and with this Kashmiri militant consortium that claim responsibility for the act. But the interesting thing is that even though there have been a lot of suggestions leaked in the Indian media in which Indian intelligence officials say that, you know, there are Pakistani handprints, footprints all over this incident, Modi himself has not come out and accused Pakistan, which is a pretty significant thing. And that may be an effort to suggest that he wants to keep up this engagement with the Pakistanis, and he's not just going to say, well, Pakistan did this, we're done talking. I don't think he wants to go there at all.
Right. I was actually just going to ask you about that, because I think the highest level thing that I've seen on the record from an Indian official is from Rajnath Singh, the Home Affairs Minister, who suggested that if Pakistan is involved, we will give a befitting reply. But Modi, as you correctly pointed out, has not really suggested that. In fact, I even saw Modi, you know, catching some flack from hawkish Indian commentators for using the phrase enemies of humanity to describe the attackers at Pathankot, which suggested a common victimhood with Pakistan, because one of the first reactions out of Pakistan, obviously, as is common, is that Pakistan is also one of the greatest victims of terrorism in the region. So I think that's it's very apt. And I think you're right that this is a road bump and not an entire derailment of the process that's on right now. So you know, just to move the conversation forward a bit, obviously Pathankot, the dust is settling, and since we don't have too many comments on the record, we'd essentially be in the realm of theorizing and a conspiracy more than actually discussing the facts when it comes to the Pakistani military's involvement. I did want to ask you, though, because, you know, when Pathankot happened, I thought about Gurdaspur, which was another attack in Punjab, thought to have been perpetrated by cross-border militants, and then we actually had pretty good evidence that the attackers had received some sort of military training. They had GPS devices, landmines, and had been fairly skilled with their weapons, which was also a hallmark of the attackers in 2008, which were Lashkar-e-Taiba gunmen. And I believe in Gurdaspur also they were thought to be Lashkar-e-Taiba militants. With Gurdaspur and 5 months later, this attack at Pathankot, do you think we're seeing a return to cross-border strikes by Pakistan-based terrorism terrorist groups? Because since 2008, there really hasn't been a major attack in India perpetrated by terrorists across the border. Do you think that the pace is starting to pick up, or are these two events essentially aberrations and not signs of a broader trend?
No, unfortunately, I fear that Gurdaspur and Pathankot could be indications of a new normal developing in India. I mean, I had written as far back as 2014 that as as U.S. Combat forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, and a lot of Pakistani militants that had been fighting in Afghanistan, including Lashkar-e-Taiba, would essentially redirect their attention back to India just because there was not as much of a need to help militant friends in Afghanistan go after U.S. troops there. They'd have basically a new window, a new opportunity to redirect their attention to India. And, you know, I had written back in 2014 as well that there were indications throughout that year, 2014, not 2015, but 2014, that a number of Kashmiri militant groups, Pakistan-based Kashmir militant groups, including Jaish-e-Mohammed, were starting to take on a more enhanced public profile, and particularly the leader of Jaish-e-Mohammed, Masood Azhar. You hadn't heard much from him for a number of years. And then all of a sudden, early in 2014, there was some sort of anti-India rally at a university in Pakistan, and his voice, he gave a lecture through, I think it was a recorded lecture, it was recorded a tape device. It's the first time his voice had been heard publicly for quite some time, and then he made all kinds of threats that he had 300 militants or 300 suicide bombers at his disposal to send to India. He threatened to assassinate Modi if he were to become prime minister. So, you know, I think that in some ways the seeds were planted, or the evidence was out there. The writing was starting to appear on the wall as far back as 2014. And I really do worry that there are going to be more of these attacks in India, and quite frankly, attacks that could be even worse. I mean, you know, we've heard the Mumbai attacks invoked to describe the level of planning involved in this Pathanko attack, which is, and you may think that's hard to believe because, you know, fortunately there were not too many deaths. It was restricted to this air base, but apparently it could have been a lot worse. I mean, there was a lot of preemptive actions by the Indian authorities to keep these militants from doing worse damage. But I really do worry that there could be a lot more attacks like this. And, you know, particularly given that, you know, the Indian and Pakistani civilian leaderships have pledged to try to, you know, resume dialogue, improve relations. I mean, if you look at the history of India-Pakistan relations, as you know, whenever there's major diplomatic progress, whenever there's some sort of attempt to resume a long suspended dialogue, something bad happens, right? I mean, you look back at 1999, there was a big diplomatic initiative between the two leaders, and then you had the Pakistani provocation leading to the Kargil conflict. And then in Mumbai in 2008, that attack followed diplomatic efforts between the two countries to get things moving forward. And then, of course, we have fast forward to today, the developments in Thailand and Paris, the Heart of Asia Conference, Modi's visit to Lahore, and then now you have this attack in Pathanko. So I try to be an optimist about these types of things, but I really do worry that we could be in for a very difficult year for India in terms of an upsurge in terror attacks.
Mm-hmm. A healthy dose of skepticism is always warranted in the subcontinent. Absolutely. Now, you know, I wonder about the strategic end goal of these terror attacks, particularly if the Pakistani military or elements within the Pakistani military or the ISI have given their imprimatur to increased attacks against military targets in India in particular, because obviously if comprehensive talks are back on, the big ticket item on the table is Kashmir. And the most likely resolution of that dispute, if left to the devices of the two civilian governments, is a formal demarcation along the line of control, which is also what the United States would like to see. But obviously, that outcome is unacceptable in many ways for the Pakistani military, which has made its raison d'etre since 1947, a broader resolution of the Kashmiri dispute and pretty much the entire incorporation of that territory into Pakistan. So, you know, I worry that if these attacks do pick up, as you've suggested, that any comprehensive talks on Kashmir will be dead on arrival. What is your sense of where comprehensive talks could go? I mean, obviously, we're still a ways out, and we haven't even seen if the foreign secretary level talk scheduled for the 15th will take place as scheduled. But if we get to the point where Kashmir is back on the table, do you think that the two governments, as things stand right now, are positioned to make real progress on the issue?
Well, I mean, it would involve such an investment of trust and goodwill that I just don't think the two sides are in a position to start talking about Kashmir. I really think that the Indians still see it as a no-go area, that as an issue, that it's been resolved. There's no need to negotiate it. Now, of course, the Indian government, by agreeing to resume the comprehensive dialogue with Pakistan, suggests that there would be some level of flexibility to talk about it, because, you know, as you know, India had refused to talk Kashmir at all until the Pakistanis did more to deal with the perpetrators of the Mumbai attacks, the LAT folks that were involved. But I think that the calculus has changed a bit by India's agreeing to resume comprehensive dialogue. But I just don't think there's enough trust, and certainly, you know, when you have something like the Pathanko attack happening just days after Modi's visit to India, to Pakistan, that will just make it more unlikely for the Indians to want to sit down and talk about these things. I mean, Modi, he's already taken a big risk in reaching out and extending the olive branch to the Pakistanis. I mean, he represents, as you know, a conservative Hindu nationalist political party that has many leaders and associated groups that want no business with Pakistan. And, you know, so it's one thing for Modi to actually reach out to Pakistan. It would be a whole other thing for him to try to be flexible about discussing Kashmir and possible solutions that, you know, would not be desired in India. Now, in terms of the Pakistani side, it's more complicated. Certainly, I mean, Kashmir is the cause celebre of the security establishment, and they want things to be done. They want the status to change. And, you know, if there is truth to the matter that this Kashmiri consortium, this UJC group, had a role in the attacks, then that would suggest that, you know, even though this airbase attack occurred in Punjab, that it was basically about Kashmir. You know, there's a lot of initial analysis that, you know, there haven't been many attacks, terror attacks in Punjab, particularly those carried out by Pakistani groups. There have been plenty in Kashmir, but not in Punjab. I mean, that suggests that despite all that, there was a Kashmir element to this attack. So, you know, bottom line is I'm not at all optimistic about there being meaningful progress in future talks if they are resumed. I think that if you want to talk about potential progress and actionable results, you may want to look at some of the non-security issues, such as trade. And India and Pakistan are very close to having a normalized trade relationship. All that has to happen is for Pakistan to essentially eliminate what's described as the negative list. In essence, it needs to eliminate the number of goods that it does not allow to be traded with India. If that happens, they'll have an MFN-type relationship, and that could be a real goodwill generator. It could be a real confidence-building measure, so that would be good. A second area of potential cooperation is on water. I mean, this has been a source of tensions, but also you do have a treaty, the Indus Waters Treaty, that tries to bring some semblance of cooperation to dealing with these shared rivers that pass through both countries. You know, maybe they could, if you have resumed dialogue, there could be some new agreement to enhance information sharing, transparency on data and information dealing with river flows, something like that. It may sound boring and technical, but I think that could be important. It could be very useful. It could be a stepping stone, you know, choose your cliche, but that could help produce the type of goodwill that would be necessary to deal with the dicier issues like Kashmir.
Mm-hmm. And those issues will certainly be something to keep an eye on this year as talks push forward. Now, I want to slowly bring this podcast to a close, but I want to ask you, as you know, someone based in Washington writing about these issues from an American perspective, about Washington's role in all of this, because we know, you know, particularly since the late 2000s, that the United States has become particularly invested in the, you know, a peace process between India and Pakistan, or if not a peace process, just the maintenance of stability. We briefly discussed Washington's role in pushing for talks when Rahil Sharif was there recently. But going forward through this year, do you expect Washington to continue to play a role in the subcontinent? And if so, how?
I think it'll keep playing the only role that it can play, and that's essentially a good office's role. It will try to work with both sides to urge them to keep talking. because the alternative for Washington is simply unfathomable, and that's tensions that grow so high they become conflicts. What the U.S. government cannot do, and I doubt it'll even try this, is to serve as some sort of formal mediator. That simply wouldn't work. I mean, quite frankly, I don't think that the U.S. would be trusted by either side to serve that role, particularly Indians, who we have to. It's important not to underplay the fact that the Indians really are simply unhappy. More than unhappy with the fact that the U.S. insists on maintaining a strong relationship with the Pakistani military and plying it with aid, with money, and with arms. So I think that from the Indian side, the U.S. is seen as far less than a credible potential mediator. And there have been efforts in history for the U.S. to try to negotiate, and they haven't really worked that well. There have been points during crises, including during the Mumbai attacks, when the U.S. government was very involved in trying to work with both sides to calm tensions. So that's good. But I think in terms of, the U.S. trying to broker some sort of peace or even a truce between these two countries, I simply don't think that can happen. So I think that what the U.S. can do is quietly urge the sides to keep talking, particularly now when, things are a lot tenser than they were right before Christmas. Essentially what the U.S. can do is bring these two sides to the negotiating table, but it cannot bring them beyond the table. So in other words, it can get them talking, but it can't do much beyond that. But getting them talking and getting them to keep talking is important in and of itself.
And what about exercising the power of the purse with the Pakistani military? And I know the United States hasn't been historically too great at actually exercising that ability, but at the end of the day, Pakistan and the United States are allies, and Pakistan relies on the United States for a lot of military support. You have the coalition support fund reimbursements. I mean, you even have other sorts of conditionality, like this idea of a nuclear deal between the United States and Pakistan that was floated late last year. Do you think, as far as the Pakistani military goes and its involvement in as a potential spoiler for peace talks go, that the United States could play a role there?
Well, I mean, I think the U.S. has leverage that it could exert over Pakistan, but it chooses not to, quite frankly. I mean, the aid has been flowing for years, and, there are these various conditionalities in place and that the United States could invoke, but it simply doesn't. I think that's unfortunate. But on the other hand, let's face it, I don't think we should overstate the leverage and the influence that the U.S. exerts over the Pakistani military. And for years, the U.S. has been telling the Pakistanis to sever its ties with militant groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, but also, groups that operate in Afghanistan and target Americans like the Haqqani Network. And, Pakistan refuses to sever those ties. And the money keeps flowing in to the Pakistani army. So I think it's important to be realistic in terms of what the U.S. can actually do. I think you may need to look at other states, particularly China, and consider what they may be able to do. That China obviously has tremendous amounts of leverage over Pakistan, given the strong degree of trust that the Pakistanis have in China and all of the infrastructure and all the aid that China provides to Pakistan. Ideally, China would do more to push Pakistan. But again, it's a complicated issue for Pakistan. These are rock-solid interests to maintain these relationships with these non-state actors like LET that, it sees as assets that could help serve its interests in a way that is certainly abhorrent to the likes of the U.S. and its Western allies. But, for Pakistan, it simply doesn't see things that way.
Absolutely, and that's a very interesting thought. And unfortunately, we're at the close of our time on this podcast, but I'd love to have you back on to talk a bit more about China and even about Afghanistan, which is something we didn't really discuss. And you discussed the Heart of Asia process and the prospects for, cooperation and competition between India and Pakistan there. But Michael, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast and for your incredible insights.
It was my pleasure. Look forward to doing it again another time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really do hope to have you back on soon. And for our listeners, thanks a lot for listening. And if you like this episode, please leave us a rating on iTunes and also a review. We'll be back next week with more. Thank you for listening.